of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:32 p.m. on Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. Present in the room today are Representative Thompson, Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Merrick. We are continuing hearing from Mr. Treg Taylor, the governor's appointee to the attorney general position. We left off this morning with questions from members. We only have Mr. Taylor until 1:55 as he has another confirmation hearing, so we will take the questions from Representatives Ortiz, Josephson, and Wohl. As your offices were informed this morning, I will not be adding any members to the list. Additional questions or those that must go over the time can be submitted to my office in writing by the end of the day, and Mr. Taylor will respond in writing. With that, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you, Mr. Taylor, for your continued willingness to come before the committee in consideration of your nomination. Mr. Taylor, you recall I was asking you at the very close of the hearing before this morning's hearing about the duty for the Department of Law to perform consumer protection within the state of Alaska. In other words, you are the sole body responsible for protecting the consumers. And I ask you in particular in relationship to the idea of protecting consumers from monopolistic practices. And you mentioned that, you know, you agreed that it was your duties, and I think you said that the duties go from consideration of the merger itself, but then continuing to monitor if, in fact, the merger takes place, continue to monitoring the activities of the companies that did the merger and the impact of that merger on consumers in the future. Am I correct in that?
Pardon me, Mr. Taylor. I'd like to recognize that we've been joined by Representatives Rasmussen and Carpenter. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Taylor.
Representative Ortiz, through the co-chairs. My apologies. I'm having a little bit of static feedback here, but I think I got the gist of the question. And yeah, I can confirm that that is indeed. We continue to monitor consumer protection issues for monopolistic practices once that merger takes place.
Thank you for that, Mr. Taylor. And with that understanding, how does it actually work once a merger has been approved? In order for the Department of Law to consider any further action, would it require continued or regular communication from concerned citizens about the impact of that merger on their lives, or would there be kind of an automatic monitoring of the situation without any consumer concern being registered directly to your office, or would it require the constituents, the consumers, to contact your office to try to bring up the issue again?
Representative Ortiz, through the co-chairs, I think it's a little bit merger specific, depending on how worried we are about the merger that took place. But I think all of the above is the answer. We'll continue to monitor within the Department of Law. Sometimes it's very helpful if concerned residents in Alaska or concerned legislators, for example, bring these issues back to our attention so we can take a closer look.
Okay. Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Okay, and thank you for that, Mr. Taylor. And going to a different topic, it is within the duties you've talked earlier about, it's within the duties of the Attorney General to advise the administration, to advise the governor on potential litigation, and that my question is around that duty. Is there a priority for do financial considerations are they in strong consideration when you're recommending to the governor as to the advisability of pursuing any particular piece of litigation? In other words, obviously you have to consider the likelihood of prevailing, but do you also have to consider you know, the amount of resources that are available to the Department of Law in order to decide which types of cases move forward?
Representative Ortiz, through the co-chairs, that's exactly right. We have to evaluate constantly how we're allocating resources within the department, where we're going to prioritize, and we're not able to take on everything that, you know, we feel that there might be a potential a cause of action for, and we discuss those very carefully with our clients, including the chief executive officer of the governor of the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Taylor, I appreciate you taking all this time with us. You spent some time in response to Representative Johnson's question talking about a cut to your agency from the subcommittee I chaired, and you alluded to the fact that maybe one of the cut positions could have helped in our battle against sex offenses. My question for you is this. Are you aware, Attorney General Taylor, that the same subcommittee gave you and wants to give you 19, that's 19 positions, new positions to battle sex crimes in Alaska? 19.
Representative Josephson, through the co-chairs, I due to the static, missed the entire middle portion of that question, so I'll attempt to address that question knowing that our time is limited. No, and that is much appreciated that you have taken into consideration those 19 additional positions. I think it's absolutely critical to the Department of Law's mission. It's critical public confidence in the criminal division's ability to prosecute those sex crimes, and given the epidemic that sex crimes in our state, and that is much appreciated. And so if I didn't answer your question with that, you'll have to repeat it, because again, there was a lot of static.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. A.G. Taylor, if the cut is maintained, isn't it true that the net result, because these are interagency receipts, would be that your coordinate divisions, criminal and civil, would have more money? Isn't that the result of that? In other words, they would not be taxed for the cost of the deputy, the chief of staff position that we voided.
Right. Representative Josephson, through the co-chairs, that chief of staff position was funded through IAs with the various divisions in the Department of Law. And so the net result of cutting GF funds is that affects elsewhere within the department. And as it relates to the division, which is the Attorney General division, that directly relates to our executive assistant and civil division legislative liaison. I can't really characterize that cut as being a zero net loss to the Department of Law.
Follow up?
But Attorney General, isn't it true that you could take the cut anywhere you wanted as long as it was in your agency? Or alternatively, you could simply bill more for those two positions. You've done that in the past. You simply tell the coordinate agencies, now I'm not taxing you for the chief of staff because that job's gone. I'm taxing you for these other two positions. There's no difference to those divisions, is there?
Representative Josephson, through the chairs, it's, you know, those agreements we have with other departments are negotiated agreements, and those are updated from time to time based upon need within those departments. But none of those department agreements cover things like the chief of staff, the executive assistant, or their legislative liaison.
Follow up? Well, I must tell you, sir, that in fact they do cover those. I'm looking at finance, Department of Law, personal services positions, funding, and in fact those positions have been or are partially at least funded by at least certainly the special assistant, the more expensive position, by interagency receipts. I'll move on to another topic. Attorney General, you've suggested in subcommittee and here that you're rethinking the Janus litigation, and that you're disinclined, you didn't say disinclined, you're rethinking. The implication was you may not invest as much in it. And I just want to make sure, when you say you may not invest as much in it, are you referring to the all of the cases? Because I see State versus ASEA, Creed-Ribeiro versus ASEA, Belgao, Woods versus ASEA. All of these are Janus-related litigations, many of them with outside counsel. Is it, does your rethinking cover and span all of those cases?
Representative Josephson, through the co-chairs, it does to a certain extent. Those two of those cases that you cited are employees of the state of Alaska that have sued the state of Alaska and their respective unions over decisions made in regarding to the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Janus. And so we have an obligation to defend the state in those lawsuits. What we have been able to do in those two suits is to stay the proceedings based upon the hope that the Supreme Court will pick up the Belgao cert, and that would be the most expeditious and the most cost-effective way to sort of have answers on the issues that we are facing as a state. And we're not alone in facing these issues. You might recall that in the Belgao amicus brief, there were multiple other states that joined us because they have similar questions. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Indiana, Louisiana, Montana, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, West Virginia. They're all wondering how to apply Janus in their state. They're all worried about lawsuits from employees of the state, just like we were sued by two. And so you're right. And my rethinking of that is how we go about most effectively coming to a resolution that's the best cost-effective approach for the state of Alaska and its residents.
I would note that those all sound like right-to-work states, and I'm not sure that I like the race to the bottom. My follow-up question, in your briefs and in your office's long memorandum written by your office in 2019, August 27th, you make the comparison to Miranda warnings, which must be given or a person can go to jail for their incriminating statements or lack of counsel, and how those become stale. And so a person in custody occasionally has to be reissued a Miranda warning. And the panel may say, where is Andy going with this? You've made the comparison with Miranda and the need for a public employee to also periodically restate, because you compared the two. You compared Miranda and criminality and the threat of prison with a person entering and joining a union. Do you still subscribe to that analogy?
Representative Josephson, through the co-chairs, I've got to be careful here because we're in active litigation on the subject, but I believe that's a mischaracterization of what we're arguing. The intent wasn't to compare people who want to join a union with people charged with crimes. The intent was to show that there are instances where a waiver of constitutional rights goes stale, just as you said. And so the idea was to show, hey, this isn't an unprecedented move by the state. We feel like this type of waiver of First Amendment rights can go stale. And so that it should be one of those things where once they waive that right, they haven't waived it into perpetuity, that they'll have a right to reevaluate that from time to time. They'll have a right to reevaluate that as they watch what their representation is doing out in the public sphere, what they're supporting, what they're not supporting. And so that the idea wasn't to compare them with criminals, but simply to show the court that there is precedent for having a waiver of constitutional rights go stale.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the co-chairs, Mr. Taylor, this is pursuant to the question that Representative Thompson asked earlier about Second Amendment rights, and I'm just going to throw a hypothetical. Let's suppose I'm at Fred Meyer's in the produce section, and an individual, a group of individuals, walks in carrying AR-15s with high-capacity magazines. Is this kind of behavior protected by the Second Amendment, in your opinion?
The right to bear arms and the right, the way that it's described under Alaska law, is individuals have a right to carry a weapon on their person. That's the law. My job as the Attorney General is to uphold the law and defend the law. And it's up to you and the legislature to create the law that I am required to defend and uphold.
Follow up?
Yeah. And if the Fred Meyer Corporation decides that for the interest of their employees or their customers, they wish that people didn't carry such weapons in their store, would that be something they could exercise?
Representative Wohl, through the co-chairs, I need to look into that, but I believe that is the case, that they're a private establishment and they own private property, and that they have the ability to determine who their clientele are, just like they can turn away a person at the front doors for any reason that isn't a protected reason, race, religion, that type of thing. They could potentially turn those individuals away. I see signs on stores throughout Alaska that say that firearms aren't allowed inside, and I believe that's supported by the law.
Follow up.
Thank you. Yeah, I see those signs too, and they usually list a statute pursuant to a certain statute. So I didn't know if Fred Meyer's was protected under statute, or for the same matter, if a bank is protected if someone wants to walk into a bank carrying an AR-15. I didn't know if that was protected behavior or not. I guess lastly, is there a duty of oversight for the Department of Law and the area of elections, like we've seen in Georgia and places like that?
Yeah, Representative Wohl, through the co-chairs, I think there is, and so, but it's really fuzzy what that role is currently, and that's why there is proposed legislation before your body that deals with some of those issues. And what it does is it basically says that credible allegations of voter fraud will be investigated and, if warranted, prosecuted, and to enable us to do the investigation, because right now we do not have that capability, nor does the Lieutenant Governor's office have the ability to conduct those investigations. And so after this past election, it became apparent that we probably needed to ask for changes to the law. And so basically what we're asking for is one attorney and two investigators so that they can conduct a civil investigation, and if the bill passes, there's civil penalties associated with that conduct, and if warranted, then make a criminal a referral.
Thank you. Last question.
Yes, last question.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Just recently, Alaska signed on to a case with Texas involving an election in yet another state. Did you support that action?
Yeah, Representative Wohl, through the co-chairs, I didn't make the decision to join that amicus brief, and so I couldn't tell you exactly why the Department of Law joined that amicus, but I can tell you some of the considerations that took place as far as discussions that were had and concerns that were had. You know, the arguments go that fraud in one state sort of disenfranchises Alaska voters, right? Because we all participate in the same election system on a national basis. That if one state fraudulently somehow, you know, skews the election, it disenfranchises all other voters. And so that we had to weigh that decision with state sovereignty. We don't want the ability of Washington State to come and tell Alaska State how to do it. We don't want, under state sovereignty, we want to be sovereigns of our state, and we want our laws to be dictated by the legislature, not by Arizona or any other state. And so that was a call that the Attorney General at the time had to make. And then there's this whole idea of separation of powers. Some of that action, and again, this is all sort of a matter of first impression, so nobody had any idea what the court was going to do with it. I knew that probably the standing was going to be an issue, and that's ultimately what the court decided, that the states didn't have standing to make those arguments. But the other issue is a separation of powers issue. You know, in the state of Alaska, like other states, it's the legislature that determines the guardrails for ensuring fair elections. And in this case, there was a non-legislative actor that changed those rules, and the question was, should they be able to? Should should the legislature have complete control over those guardrails? And so, in this case, it was various courts throughout the those states involved in that litigation, and basically the court says, yes, we know what the legislature said, but given a pandemic, we're going to change the rules for these elections. And so that was a matter of first impression, and that was a matter that it would be great if we had some resolution on, because I believe you down in Juneau have the ability to determine how to create the fairest elections and how to enfranchise every Alaskan voter to make them have confidence in the system. And so that's a long answer to a short question, and I apologize for rambling on.
Thank you. I guess I just want to say that although we'd all voted, quote unquote, in the same election, one could argue there were actually 50 elections because each state runs its own elections individually. But thank you for your answer.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, we appreciate you being here today. And with that, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, the House Finance Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. Treg Taylor, Attorney General, Department of Law. And this does not reflect an intention by any member to vote for or against this individual during any further session for the purpose of confirmation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is there an objection? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork, pass the gavel for the rest of this afternoon's agenda. And again, we thank Mr. Taylor for taking time to join us. Brief at ease.
House Finance, back on record. The time is 1:57 p.m. And just for the record, we've also been joined by Representative Edgman. And today we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday with regard to the subcommittee closeouts. And we've only got five left. And so the next three, Representative Co-Chair Merrick and her staff will have Military and Veterans Affairs, Public Safety, and Natural Resources. I'd like to invite up Ms. Jamie Jones. And is she doing? You can put yourself on the record and go ahead and get started.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Jamie Jones, staff to Representative Merrick. Today I'll be presenting three agency fiscal year 2022 House Finance Budget Subcommittee narrative reports. I'll start with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Were all members able to find their DMVA narrative to follow along?
And it'll be a couple pages in. I think we're all, maybe give it 10 more seconds, let everybody get their papers here. Okay, I think we're good. Please proceed.
Okay. The Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs submits the following recommendation for FY 2022. The numbers only budget with amendment recommendation totals are $22,066,300 of unrestricted general funds, $178,400 of designated general funds, $12,061,200 of other funds, and $31,377,300 of federal funds, for a total of $65,683,200. There is no difference from the FY22 governor's request to the FY22 House subcommittee recommended budget. Under positions, the recommendations are 281 permanent full-time positions, no part-time or temporary positions, for a total of 281 positions. The subcommittee held four meetings with the department analyzing the governor's budget and accepted all of the budget action items proposed. There were no member amendments submitted to the DMVA Finance Subcommittee for consideration. This completes the actions taken by the DMVA Subcommittee. And Mr. Chair, if there are no questions, I'll move on to my next overview.
Do we have any questions for Military and Veterans Affairs? I don't see any questions, so. Okay, we'll move on to the next department.
All right, next, the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Natural Resources submits the following recommended operating budget for FY22. The numbers only budget with amendment recommendation totals are $63,376,600 of unrestricted general funds, $39,198,000 $200 of designated general funds, and $36,089,500 of other funds, and $17,483,400 of federal funds, for a total of $156,147,700. Under positions, the recommendations are 623 permanent full-time positions, 247 permanent part-time positions, and 58 temporary positions, for a total of 928 positions. The only difference from the FY22 governor's budget to the FY22 House subcommittee budget recommendation is $200,000 in general fund program receipts, adding six temporary positions. The subcommittee held five meetings with the department analyzing the governor's budget and accepted all budget action items proposed. The committee also passed two member amendments, an amendment which increases park management access and receipt authority by $200,000 to add six temporary Alaska Conservation Corps crew members, with intent language stating that the department only fill the additional Alaska Conservation Corps positions authorized by the legislature if the fee collections enable this expenditure to occur without using carry forward revenue. And an amendment which adds intent language requesting that the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys submit to the House Finance Co-Chairs and Legislative Finance Division a proposal to conduct large geophysical and geochemical and geological data collections over the mineral-rich portions of the state and develop fee schedules to charge for the raw data by December 1st, 2021. This completes the actions taken by the DNR Subcommittee. And Mr. Chair, if there are no questions, I'll move on to my last overview.
Do we have any questions for Department of Natural Resources? I don't think I see any questions. Let me, just a quick question on the number two, the Parks Management and Access. So that would be six temporary positions, and again, it's only filled if the fee collections enable this expenditure to occur without using carry forward revenue. So in other words, as long as the fees that are collected pay for those positions, is that
correct? Yeah, that's correct, yes.
Okay. Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to highlight for the committee's awareness about conversation that we had regarding budget action item 10, the request for $250,000 in general funds for the increased funding for law enforcement in the parks. I think that this is a very appropriate request, and I am hoping that our full finance will have a discussion about looking at program receipts. Alaska pays relatively low fees for parking lots and access to these parks, and it's a way that we could also collect additional revenue, and minor amounts of revenue from tourists who are visiting our states and using our parks as well, rather than general fund spend.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions or comments? I don't see any. So with that, we'll move over to the third department. Ms. Jones?
Thank you. Lastly, the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Public Safety submits the following recommended operating budget for FY22. Was everybody able to get to that DPS narrative?
I think everybody's got it.
Okay, the numbers only budget with amendment recommendation totals are $180,264,600 of unrestricted general funds, $8,663,600 of designated general funds, $12,223,200 of other funds, and $28,033,900 of federal funds, for a total of $229,185,300. There is a decrease of $238,600 in unrestricted general funds from the FY22 adjusted base to the House Subcommittee budget recommendation, which is a 0.1% decrease. Under positions, the recommendations are 873 permanent full-time positions, 18 permanent part-time positions, and 20 temporary positions, for a total of 911 positions. The subcommittee for DPS held six meetings with the department analyzing the governor's budget, accepted 20 and rejected 3 of the 23 proposed budget action items. The committee also passed 4 intent language amendments by members. An amendment stating that it is the intent of the legislature that the Department of Public Safety Plan Review Bureau allocate appropriate resources to ensure that the review time of the building plans be kept under 30 days. An amendment stating that it is the intent of the legislature that the Department of Public Safety prioritize the development of law enforcement resources to non-urbanized areas that lack organized government. An amendment stating that it is the intent of the legislature that no funds shall be moved outside of the personal services line of any allocation within the Alaska State Troopers appropriation. And lastly, an amendment stating that it is the intent of the legislature that the Department of Public Safety increase efforts to fill vacant positions with an Alaska State Troopers appropriation and reduce overtime in order to better manage within the authorized budget. The department should provide 2 reports to the co-chairs of finance and the Legislative Finance Division, the first no later than December 1st, 2021, and the second no later than July 1st, 2022. That details monthly hiring and attrition, as well as premium and overtime costs by category, and describes any contributing factors from the start of the fiscal year to the month preceding the due date of the report. And this concludes all recommendations from the DMVA, DNR, and DPS subcommittees. Thank you.
Do we have any questions on the Public Safety Department? Representative Josephson?
Could I have just a half a minute?
Oh, at ease. Okay, and back on record, House Finance Representative Josephson.
Yes, I'm sure I'm missing something here, but through the chair, the page two of the narrative refers to an item that was not accepted, and it's the third one that caught my eye, the full funding of 28 new positions added at 75%. Can I get a further explanation of that?
Ms. Jones?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. In 2021, the department got 75% funding for, I think it was 36 total new positions. The majority of them haven't been filled yet. And so the subcommittee did not approve the remaining 25% funding for 2021 for those positions. The positions that we knew were filled, which would be line item 11, 12, we funded positions that were filled, fully funded, 100%. The positions that were filled.
Let me follow up there. Thank you.
And Ms. Jones, regarding VPSO program, as I understand it, no cuts were made to the program. Is that correct?
No cuts were made to VPSO.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions for public safety? Representative Carpenter.
I guess, Mr. Chair, just a quick question. You said there are no cuts, but there's a decrease in unrestricted general funds, so we made up the money somewhere else.
So my question was, were there any cuts to the VPSO program?
VPSO.
Yeah, yep.
My apologies.
No problem. Okay, so I don't see any questions for public safety, so with that, we will move over to, thank you, Ms. Jones. We'll move over to governor and legislature, and I'd like to call up my staff. I chaired those committees, subcommittees, and that would be Mr. Patrick Fitzgerald. If you could put yourself on the record. Maybe let's give everyone just a quick moment to grab their closeout report. Will you be starting with governor first or legislature?
Patrick Fitzgerald, through the chair. I'll be starting with the governor.
Governor, okay. Let me find my closeout report here. Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My name is Patrick Fitzgerald. I am staff for Co-Chair Foster. I'm here to present the subcommittee closeout report for the Office of the Governor. The FY22 budget request from the Office of the Governor is as follows. $23,215,000 unrestricted general funds, $0 in designated general funds, $3,087,000 in other funds, as well as $229,000 in federal funds, bringing the total to $26,532,000. The unrestricted general fund difference from FY22 adjusted base to House Cubs subcommittee budget recommendation is an increase of $950,000 of unrestricted general funds, which is 4.3% above FY22 adjusted base. There are 151 permanent full-time positions with the Office of the Governor, 0 permanent part-time positions, as well as 23 temporary positions with the Office of the Governor, bringing the total to 174 positions. Budget action items taken up in the subcommittee were the approval of 2 PCN transfers from the Department of Commerce to the Office of the Governor, the denied creation of admin service allocation within OMB, replaced $200,000 of interagency receipts with general funds and reduced receipt authority within OMB, deleted hollow receipts authority and authorized 706 UGF for expected costs within the Division of Elections in response to the ballot initiative that passed in November 2020. intent language from the Office of the Governor is that OMB reviews single audit costs, amount billed to federal government, and reimbursements. That concludes a closeout report from the Office of the Governor, and I am happy to answer any questions.
So just to summarize, the bulk of the increase for that $950,000, can you just summarize that? It looks like it's the two items, the budget analysis as well as the Division of Elections.
Absolutely. A bulk of that, through the chair, a bulk of that increase came from the Division of Elections, which they requested the money for cards and maps, voting cards and voting maps for the redistricting, as well as costs included with the new ranked choice voting system that is being implemented.
Okay. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two PCMs transferred from DCCED, is that the governor's economic development team, or can you explain what those positions are?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Wool. I'll actually default to Mrs. Cunningham.
Representative Edgman?
Yes, it is to Representative Wool's question. It's the two positions that were with the Alaska Development Team that were housed in the Department of Commerce were transferred from Commerce into the governor's office. This completes the transaction.
Thank you, because that question came up the other day if that transaction was completed, and looks like it is.
Do we have any further questions on Office of the Governor? Seeing none, let's move over to legislature.
Once again, my name is Patrick Fitzgerald, staff for Co-Chair Foster. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Legislature submits the following report to House Standing Committee. The FY22 budget request for the legislature is as follows. $64,921,000 in unrestricted general funds, $341,000 in designated general funds, $1,462,000 in other funds, and $0 in federal funds, bringing the total to $66,725,000. The unrestricted general fund difference from FY22 adjusted base and to the House Subcommittee budget recommendation is an increase of $393,000 of unrestricted general funds, which is a 0.6% increase above FY22 adjusted base. There are 258 permanent full-time positions with the legislature, 288 permanent part-time positions, as well as 28 temporary positions, bringing the total to 574 positions. Actions taken by the House Budget Subcommittee for the legislature are approval of legislative budget and audit and legislative council's requested budgets, approval of $232,000 of UGF to replace the restorative justice funds for the Office of Victims' Rights. Denied performance review for alleged audit in the amount of $1,395,000 of UGF. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Legislature also heard a presentation from the Redistricting Board, who requested an amendment to the FY21 appropriation for an additional $1 million, which the subcommittee recommends to the House Finance Standing Committee. The final recommendation for the subcommittee is an amendment for a one-time increment of $1 million to the legislative audit to perform their constitutionally required audit while they work with OMB in the Department of Administration on establishing a payment rate. That concludes my report for the legislature, and I'm ready to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions, Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The added expense of COVID to the legislature, is that, where would I see that in this, I guess that'd be last year's budget, as how would I see the, I assume it's under the legislature, the testing and beacon, the beacon contract, where would that be in this budget?
Through the chair, I do believe that that would be under Legislative Council's budget.
Representative Wool.
And is that the request for the, there's a request for increase in Leg Council? I'm assuming that budget went up, I guess is my question, due to COVID.
Through the chair, yes. The Legislature Budget Subcommittee approved Legislative Council's budget request in full.
Which, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Edgman?
Did I sit on that subcommittee? I believe it's FY21, and it's related to CARES Act money, so you wouldn't see it in FY22.
That sounds correct, and I'm seeing the yes from the corner back there. Representative Edgman, or Ortiz, did you have a?
Perhaps it's a follow-up on Representative Wool's question. So the bulk of the $393,000 increase is primarily seen where? Increase in UGF funds?
Through the chair, to Representative Ortiz, I believe that would be the increase with the approval of the Legislative Budget and Audit Subcommittee, or Legislative Budget and Audit and Leg Council's requested budget.
Okay, thank you.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you can maybe go a little bit deeper into an explanation on the additional $1 million appropriation to be embedded in House Bill 69 for the redistricting board budget piece, if somebody could help me just see the total picture on that.
Right, yes, Representative LeBon, I'll comment on that. So that's a subcommittee recommendation, so that's not built into the actual numbers that you see on page one here. So we'll take that up as a possible amendment in full finance. But in the legislature subcommittee, we have the redistricting board request to us the additional $1 million. So far, they've got $2.5 million that was appropriated last year, and it was a multi-year appropriation for FY 21 and 22. They have since had some issues with, due to COVID, the national census has been slowed up, and they've been paying rent and all kinds of things for this first year, and so their work is going to be slowed up. But more importantly, 10 years ago, the redistricting board went through about $7.5 million with lawsuits and so forth, and so they felt like 2.5 was good, but they felt like at least adding one more million, making it $3.5 million, is still less than the $7 million that we spent 10 years ago, and they are afraid that if we try to come back later, if they need the money, but of course we, you know, come back in a session just this time each year, and the timing may not work to their favor. And so they've put this request in, and they're also requesting that it's extend not just from FY21-22, but also into 23. But like I say, this is something that at this point has not been accepted by the subcommittee, and it'll be taken up by the full finance committee. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that explanation. It makes total sense, I guess. And maybe this isn't a fair question for now and here today, but do they anticipate a timely response to their duty of carrying out the actions of the redistricting board? Are they going to need more time? Because I see the date was extended another year on the use of the monies.
Mr. Fitzgerald.
Through the chair, to Representative LeBon, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, census data has kind of been delayed in the process, and they want to be sure that they have a map that is as viable as possible. So the reason for an extension equates a big part on the deadlines that they need to meet as a board in order to accommodate the redistricting completion by the 2022 election.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, and I was going to add that the redistricting board has 30 days after receipt, I think, of the census data to put a draft plan together. They've got 90 days to put a plan together that would then almost assuredly and in this go around be more susceptible to litigation. 10 years ago and henceforth it was the Voting Rights Act litigation, Section 5 and minority representation and all that. This time around it's expected because the Census Bureau's collection of census data is going to be challenged in state, probably federally as well. That additional money that's coming into, as Chair Foster alluded, the 2.5 that was already in the budget, the $1 million henceforth, a whole lot smaller than $7 million, but it would position the redistricting board to be able to provide counsel to fend off the litigation, which again is going to be, I'm not going to say guarantee, but it's pretty well assured. But very different litigation atmosphere than 10 years ago.
Correct. Thank you, Representative Edgman. Do we have any further questions or comments on legislature? Seeing none, that concludes all of the subcommittee reports. And that concludes the rest of our business today. If there is nothing else to come before the committee, we will go ahead and adjourn at 2:25 p.m. Thank you.